Okay, we're live. Thanks everyone for joining us today. Today we've got a great guest. Introduction from Chris Whitaker, or Chris, yeah, Chris Witt. Thanks, Whitaker from Chris is that now. Nonetheless, introduction to Bill Stinnett. Bill Stinnett's a 37-year sales coach leader,
Started when I was 4 years old, yes,
when
sir.
you're 4 years old, hustle lemonade stands. Bill has written a number of books on this topic, and we're very lucky to have him join us today. Especially the topic of getting to hell yes. Our conventional architecture story or conversation flow will be a little bit different today because we want to make sure Bill has ample opportunity to talk about some of the things that you write about in your books and things that people can hear from in our audience around getting to hell yes. A lot of things we talk about on this show, as everyone knows, is really about like finding that getting to hell yes buyer. And often we talk about other people's stories and what they do and the tactics that they take to find the hell yes buyer, specifically in property management and real estate. Oh, do you? Okay. 1 second. I'll just change spaces. I'm just in a live. Ooh, I thought I had a free room here. I'm gonna get bumped. That'll be interesting. That'll be the first time that's ever happened to me before. And nonetheless, we
Weather.
will. What's that? You're okay? You're not coming? Okay, thank you. Good, because I'm live. Well, that's what happens when you steal a conference room at a
No
conference. It's now
attention
and
to the
then.
man behind the curtain, right?
That's right. That's right. Okay, where was I? On the conversation of getting now, yes. Lots, the goal of the conversations that we have on the show are to help people share stories around what they do to get to hell yes and how they look at the customer journey, how they understand their customers, tactics, strategies, and even some of the kind of uncomfortable questions around objections, alternatives, and creating a commitment to change. So with Bill today, we're going to get into some of the kind of like classic conversations that all of us need to learn or relearn as we're going through the sales process and as we're learning how to sell. Now, I think one of the things that Bill and I were just chatting before the show is that sales is emerging as one of the very defensible roles in the world when you take a look at this external disruption that's happening and being forced upon us today. And that external disruption can be a number of different things. There's the political things that are happening, there's trade things that are happening. And of course, you've got artificial intelligence that's accelerating change all around us, and that's virtually impossible to ignore. So excited to get started with Bill today. Thanks, Chris, for the introduction today. And we'll kick it off like we always do. Bill, a little bit of your background. How did you get into this role? And let's go from there.
How did I get into this role?
That's right.
Well, I failed in music school, was how I got into this role.
Like
Was
Alan Greenspan. I think Greenspan was in Juilliard, so there you go. You might have been
he
partners.
really?
Yeah.
Well, I knew I was going to be a speaker when I was 14 years old. I was invited to a bass fishing seminar, and I heard two guys teaching people how to catch bass. And I just knew at that instant, 14 years old, I said, that's what I'm going to do for a living. But I didn't know exactly what it was going to be. I thought maybe I'd go to music school. I've got a little background in that growing up and thought I'd be a professor and did really well at the first school that I went to and University of Northern Colorado. And then I transferred to one of the top music schools in the country called New England Conservatory of Music in Boston. And I went from being one of the better players in school to one of the worst players in school.
I bet.
And right, because that's a Juilliard level school.
Yeah.
And so when I say I failed out, I didn't get kicked out, but I just determined pretty quick that this is not what I was probably going to be doing. And so I was looking for a way to make, I found some guys that were making a lot of money in sales. And I said, whatever it is you're doing, I want in.
Yep. Excellent. And how did you get up in the coaching role? Like you had obviously there's some professional development. You did some work. You sold. And then
Yeah.
you ended up in the coaching and the authorship side of things, which is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. So in 1988, I started selling. And one of the first things I started doing is listening ca to cassette tapes. Now, any of your audience members that aren't familiar with what a cassette tape is, I'm sure you could find one at your local museum and learn about that. But I listened to cassette tapes by all these really great motivational speakers. And I heard one named Zig Ziglar.
Oh,
And
yeah.
I find people everywhere I go that say that they were influenced by Zig. Well, I was so blown away by what I heard him doing for a living, I wanted to pursue the path that he did so that someday I could be a speaker just like Zig. Now, I'm not just like Zig by any means, But I got a little bit of zig in that I've been able to do this for the last 24 years as a teacher and a coach and a consultant and an advisor to sales organizations. And I did, like you said, publish a few books along the way. So I kind of went in Zig's direction. I never made it big like he did.
And folks are reaching out to you, and this is kind of like preempt the conversation in terms of like the problems that you solve and why you're different. And again, like the methodologies that you teach, like why, you know, I mean, other than the fact that we're not hitting a potential, but like people get stuck in an equilibrium, things are going okay. And then they seek to find a sales professional that can help them with coaching. What problems are people approaching you with? And then I guess the first question is, what's the problem they're approaching you with? And then second to that, when you go look and you're starting to diagnose and really kind of activate the coaching, what are the very most common problems that you see when you're talking to sales pros or sales organizations?
That's a really good question. Thank you. So let's kind of take that in a couple of angles, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
So when I started the business in 2001, I had a career, as you indicated, in enterprise software sales. So it made sense to me that I would be maybe helping other people in that same space, the IT space. So I developed a couple of courses. One I called Power Prospecting for a new business, which was something I'd done a lot of. And also I created a course called Selling to C-Level Executives, which was a skill that I developed through the 90s that paid off big time in terms of being able to sell large multi-million dollar transactions at the C-level. And when I approached prospective clients or attracted prospective clients, boy, there was a lot of need for that. So I don't think that's changed much. I still think that a lot of companies are interested in building their pipeline. So prospecting is never going to go get old. I published a new book on that topic just a couple of years ago called The Digital Selling Handbook. So it's kind of like prospecting for 2025. Mm-hmm. And selling to executives is never going to get out of style because, as you indicated before, we talked about before the show started, their real differentiator in sales is to be able to articulate what it is we're actually going to do for the client, how it's going to impact their business or their personal lives. And when we're selling at that kind of level, if we want to differentiate from other salespeople, selling a little bit higher and being able to sell the value at that higher level is really key. So those were a couple of the topics. Although, if you don't mind me continuing here, the other angle of this, that today I get a different kind of call.
So I'm curious to hear this.
There's still this need for salespeople to learn how to prospect well, learn how to sell to executives, sell value, et cetera. And of course, negotiation skills and a bunch of other things. But my customer has always been, back up, my customer's never really been the salesperson themselves. So I don't offer courses, for example, for an individual to sign up for $99 or $999. My customer is a sales executive. Man or woman leading a sales team saying, I got 40 people or 400 people. We need to get better at something. So the call I'm getting now from that executive is not so much my people need to learn to prospect better or my people need to learn how to sell to executives better. The call I'm getting today is my people are scared to death. My people are freaked out by how much the market's changing, how much our own company is changing. We've got reorgs every 30 minutes. We've got discouragement. We've got bewilderment. We've got morale problems, and I can't get people to change as fast as we are changing as a company, and I need some help with culture and how to get salespeople to change and keep up with the pace of how fast the market and our own company is changing. So my business has moved away from only doing sales skills training to now I'm kind of in the, if you could call it change manager, I call it change leadership. Business.
Yeah. And do you think that that's, you know, it's funny when you're out there selling, you know, my personal story here is my junior, like my oldest is a junior in college and he's looking for a summer job right now. And he's talking about getting into sales and he's looking at two different sales opportunities. One of them is, and both are door to door. And I'm a huge proponent. I'm like, go do it, dude, go do it. Go, you know, get the nose, right? Go, you know, eat, S-H-I-T, Right? That's what you got to do to learn how to get that and do it early when you got not much else to sell, to lose. He has two alternatives before him. He's got pest control opportunity and then solar panels, kind of classic summer student stuff. I said to him, well, I'll tell you what, do you want to make it easy on yourself or hard on yourself? He said, well, obviously I like it easy on yourself. I go, which one of those is a pain? And which one of those is nice to have? I said, well, pest controls seems to be a bigger of a pain. I said, yeah, that's a pain. You can just, you know, we want to get, you see mouse droppings, you activate, right? Solar panel, you can kick that down the road for a while.
Yeah.
So what do you think? And people move on. Loss aversion theory, right? You're back at your background of psychology well exceeds mine. And, you know, so focus on the pain. And so he's activating on a pain sales cycle this summer. We'll see how that plays out. But I'm curious, when you're talking about everyone talking to you right now, they're not seeking, it doesn't sound to me like they're seeking for incremental improvement. It sounds to me like they're seeking to solve kind of like all this structural change that has created a tremendous amount of friction and pain in their organizations. And they need help. They're not tooled up. They're not equipped.
Yeah, I hate to say that we're somehow past sales skills, because we never will be. I think that even for people that have been selling 20, 25 years, when we come into a workshop, it's a game changer. They walk out of there thinking differently about how they sell. We've got plenty of new people coming into the profession. But as we said here, you just mentioned, maybe there's something that's taking precedence here that is about getting people to do, in a lot of cases, what they already know how to do. So it's not uncommon for us to come into an organization that has already invested $1 million or $20 million in some sort of a sales training methodology. They've developed their own sales training courses. They've even got an internal sales training team. We've got an instructional design department internally. We've got all these resources. We've got more training than our salespeople even have time to take, and they won't use it. We're providing all these technology tools to automate this and automate that. In fact, we've automated them to death, and they won't use the tools. So my job, interestingly enough, has become come in and help to drive execution on plans we've already got, drive adoption for systems that we've already invested in, and drive application of methodologies that are not complex, but are in some cases cumbersome or confusing or just not that useful to salespeople, and help to reformat things such that salespeople actually want to do it. So I'm in the business of helping sales organizations utilize the tools and the systems and the technologies and the training that they've already got. That has become my business today.
So often do you hear the complaint that our sales folks just won't use Salesforce?
Constant.
I mean, we actually had people, one of my previous companies, we had people hired just to do the Salesforce work for the sales folks, because the sales folks were just unwilling to kind of do the lift right, in order to get things through. And so,
but let me make a couple comments on that as soon as you're done. Sorry.
No, and it was often, it was either there's one of two excuses, and these aren't reasons, they're excuses. It was the excuse was, well, we'd rather have our salespeople selling than entering stuff into Salesforce. And that was the complaint from the sales teams, right? It's like, hey, would you rather have me selling or pounding in deal details in Salesforce? Okay, there's that one. And then the other one was that, well, salespeople, they're just not really good at admin, was kind of like the second one. And so those are kind of like excusing away bad behavior or non-commitment to change. You know, if I go back to even thinking of the challenger sale kind of principles of like the wildcat salesperson, right, who would go out there and get the drive their own deal kind of pipe independent of the collective pipe, but, you know, eventually bring in a deal that would make their numbers, that kind of thing. Like, what do you hear, and what those are my guesses from my side, but what are you hearing from your side, and how is it mitigated or remediated from a discipline perspective?
Okay. You're going to be surprised at my response, because it's going to sound like I'm going to argue with you here, but
sure.
Take this in the direction it's intended. So when salespeople resist using something, I find it's never that they're lazy. Not a single time. It's that it actually doesn't really help them to do this work. So we have to look at the motive behind some of these systems. And I'm going to use an example here of Well, a tool like Outreach or Sales Loft, for example. Fantastic tools for automating an outreach sequence or a prospecting sequence, right? And there are a lot of other things these tools do as well, but that's the core function, is to define an outreach pattern and then execute on that pattern. So we invest $5 million in Outreach or Sales Loft or something, and we want salespeople to start doing this. And they won't do it. Why won't they do this? Well, there might be one or three different reasons. Number one is that it is the motive behind using it is so that sales managers can get a visibility or insight into what salespeople are doing. They want to micromanage who's calling who and who's sending an email to who at any given time so I can see this data. That's fine. But if the motive is simply, I want to be able to see what people are doing and it's not set up to actually help them do their job, then naturally they're going to resist. There's this law in psychology of this, you know, path of least resistance, if you will, right? Path of least effort. And people will choose the least effort to get the best result. If somebody has to sit there and type extra stuff in, or they've got to sit there and rejigger a system for 5 minutes before they can send an email, naturally they're going to resist. So if we look at motive, first of all, that tells us a lot because it may not be designed to actually help them. It's designed and put together so somebody else can look at the data. Number two is that the quality or the content that's in it can be garbage. And so it's not uncommon to have a Salesforce implementation, for example, that is set up in a too cumbersome way. There's too darn many forms, fields to fill out to enter a contact or a prospect or an opportunity. But just as much, you'll find when you dig into them, these databases are incredibly dirty. We don't know who owns these accounts. We have duplicate entries in there and on and on and on. So what I'm trying to say is if this thing is difficult to use and it's going to burn up my time, why would I want to use it? And I find that tons of salespeople and lots of sales managers do all their business in a spreadsheet and then throw it into Salesforce or something the night before we're going to do account reviews or opportunity reviews because it's just easier to work on the spreadsheet. Now, this is not because Salesforce or Outreach or any of these tools are bad. The implementation can be, not very well done. And the quality of the content or the data within it can be so dirty or so antiquated or so junk that it's just not worth using. So I'm here defending the sales guys. Like, wait a second. Don't pick on my sales guys because I love my sales guys. We have to make it something that they actually, it's easy to use and that they want to use. Make it helpful to them. And then we might see a little bit different behavior. So that's my approach to it.
Interesting. And so when you take about, I mean, you just came out with a book on change from the salesperson's perspective, or one of your first books was on change and sales implementations. And so like when you kind of tie those things together, It you know, when you, especially when you talk about the theme of this show about getting to hell yes, right? It sounds as though many of the implementations from a technology perspective don't consider the behavior of the end user when they're, you know, modeling the implementation.
Yeah. Remember I said there were three different things we have to keep in mind. Number one's motive. Yeah. Number two is the quality of the information that's in a system. Number three thing we have to think about, does it actually benefit the customer at all? Mm-hmm. Because we can look, does it help management? Does it help a sales guy do their job better? But is it actually improving the customer experience? So something like an automated email sequencer that sends out garbage content every other day is not beneficial and helpful to the customer. And so we have to think about, I think, from all three angles. In fact, the number three, does it help the customer, might need to be number one because that's where it all begins. So yes, we have to look at how these things are used and then design these and build these in a way that it's actually helping people, helping management, helping salespeople, and helping the customer as well.
Does it become a little bit vulnerable as a sales manager when you're looking to map out these systems? So you can, you know, create, I mean, the goal is to create inertia around the sales motion so it's repeatable, right? And not just implement a system. And like, do you find that a lot of sales managers, when they look to deploy these things, they're vulnerable in the fact that they become to realize that their sales process is not really standardized, that it's vulnerable to the whims of the salespeople. And so they're not actually you know, we don't have, you know, we may think we've got a pre-bake model. We may think we've got playbooks, but no one's using them. We think we've got sales decks, but everyone has their own. We think we've got call scripts, but everyone does it their own way. And so if I were to go and deploy it and try and harmonize it to a mediocre middle, we're actually kind of depowering everybody that's closing deals.
Wow. You're teeing me up for some great responses, my friend.
I live it myself. We're a small sales organization, and I find myself just kind of, oh no, I haven't done this right. You know, I got to go back to the basics.
Yeah. This is so good. So let me just make a couple comments here, because again, I will fight for my salespeople, because in the end, I got to get them excited about doing this, or the whole thing is for naught, right? If I don't, if a sales guy doesn't want to use this stuff, they're going to find a way not to use it. I guarantee you.
I think that's a great point, right?
So you said, how do we make this something that people want to use and something that is worth using? Isn't that what the question or
no? Well, the question was really around like, do sales managers, like when we go and look to deploy a system, for starters, it's hard to get salespeople in a room to provide their input because they're busy selling.
Oh, you said standardize. Yeah.
Standardize to consolidate it to even a 60% solution or 65%, model of how we deploy sales. So you can map it into technology. So you can get the inertia around a repeatable sales motion. Right.
Yeah.
And then be able to deploy it to salespeople that are going to accept the solution.
Yeah.
Whereas let's talk about that.
So I've been doing this for a very long time, as you said. And when I got into this business of teaching sales, there were already a dozen great sales methodologies out there. And there's been a few more added even since then. And all of these have some sort of a sales process, the steps we're going to go through to sell something to a customer. And of course, most companies recognize it's not a bad idea to have a standardized sales process, right? You got this first stage, and here are the things we do. And then we move to the next stage, and here are the things we do in that stage. There's a lot of value in having a codified, organized sales process that we can follow. But here's what ends up happening with that. We get so wrapped around the axle of the things that we're going to do and the steps that we're going to take and the internal systems we're going to use and the boxes that we're going to check, that a lot of times it doesn't even align with the way the customer's buying. So you mentioned I wrote a book 24 years ago. I wrote a book called Think Like Your Customer. And this wasn't new in those days. And it's not new today. But you'd think it would be. Because in this book, one of the things that I talk about pretty extensively is how to align your sales process to the customer's buying process. Because we can have a sales process and I can work through that all day long and check the box next to every little thing I'm supposed to do and still not close a deal. What has to happen here are the things that I'm doing have to lead the customer to take the next step in their process. So if we define what the customer has to do in order to buy, we align our sales process to that, you'll find a lot more salespeople buy into it. We teach salespeople how to ask better questions of the customer, align with the customer's buying process, and become a partner to them to facilitate the process, as opposed to pushing them toward closure by the end of my quarter, which is what we all want to do, right? To get the deal in.
Yeah.
We need to align with what the customer's doing. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm not going to try to influence the customer's timetable. Absolutely going to do that. And when possible, I'll try to align it with the end of our quarter. Absolutely. But if I am unaware of the steps they have to go through, the people that have to provide approval, et cetera, then a salesperson in out there in action is going to do what they need to do to facilitate the buying process. And a lot of times it doesn't line up with our checkboxes. That's because our checkboxes usually aren't built to be aligned with the way customers buy.
And do you find that, like, so when you go to dissect that and break that down, and you know, I've been in this spot before where we found ourselves in retrospect, like really almost embracing the fact that every deal was a brand new deal. Mm-hmm. Everything seemed like a white piece of paper every single time we started. And you know, in a retrospect of the year or the 2 years prior, you know, we kind of looked at ourselves and said, well, you know, we're catching wins here. We're not making wins, you know, like we're not actually driving the experience. We're catching wins. That's the best way I can say it. And And I find that, like, when asked to step what the repeatable process is and what the buyer's journey is, so we can align it, even then it was like, we don't know.
Yeah.
Let's just keep throwing energy at it. Right. And so how do people start to understand and codify that specific part of understanding? And I mean, okay, there's some, yeah, know your ICP. Oh, that's great. Right. Those are great pieces of information. Who's your buyer? But like, ultimately breaking it down into like, how do you quality check that? Because what I've seen in my past, I've done it myself, is I've seen that, you know, the checklist of things you got to do to be able to build out your sales process. And the box was checked, but in retrospect, we checked the box, put it on the shelf and been doing with it. Or we checked the box, but the quality was not nearly the depth that needed to stand up to the smoke test in order to be able to be something that we could repeat. So what do you, where do you start? How do you begin to kind of quality assure those inputs?
Yeah, very good. So there are specific things that we need to ask a customer about their buying process. And so I have two different sizes. I've got a 7-question format and a 20-question format, depending on the size and the complexity of the deal. But we have to standardize at least on, we're all going to ask these questions of any customer who's looking at buying, and we're going to forecast the deal this month. Now, if we've got a deal that might close maybe sometime, then I think you should still ask these questions. But if we're going to forecast this thing, and we're going to say, Mr. Vice President, we're going to bring in this $100,000 or this $1 million by the end of the quarter, we better know the answer to some questions. And so some of these questions are going to be things like, what's the motive? Why are they going to buy something in the first place? What's really driving this? What bad problem are they concerned with? Or what goal are they trying to achieve? Number two, urgency. When do they need to get this done? Because I've met a lot of customers who have big problems that just never got around to solving them. I always joke around with people. I got all kinds of needs in my own personal life that I never get around to fixing.
Shop desk has been dirty for 7 or 8 years.
There you go. And why is it dirty? Because I can get by without it. I can get by without doing that. And you're busy doing other things that you can't put off. And so number one is motive. Number two is urgency. What can't you put off? Here's number three question. We need to be asking this about every forecasted deal. Consequence. What bad thing happens if the customer doesn't buy? What bad thing do they encounter if they don't buy? Because customers a lot of times are driven to avoid consequences more than they are to perceive or pursue gain. Yeah. And that's you said about psychology. That's psychology right there, is looking at consequence to the client. I would dare say if there's not a strong enough motive, if there's no real urgency and there's no consequence to inaction, most of those deals will probably push at least a month, 2 months, and in some cases never close. You might also want to look at something like payback or return, right? If they're going to put in $1 million, what do they get back? I need to look at organizational alignment, because it's not just one person's opinion of our motive, urgency, and consequence. It's if I've got 4 or 5 different people in an organization that all need to be on the same page and are going to have to take a step in the process. Well, they all better be aligned on a motive, urgency, and consequence and some sort of a time frame. And so a variety of topics like that. But that's the thing I like to help people standardize on, is some specific things that we need to ask customers. And then number two, once we are qualifying better, better understanding deals, we need to look at the actions and the steps the customer takes. Let me give you an example of this. So one of my large clients, this started in 2016. So that's a long time ago, right? 9 years ago, engaged to help them improve forecast accuracy. Their big concern was, how is it that we have conversion rate from stage 4 in our process to stage 5 in our process, where we're going to close a deal? How is it that our conversion rate is so darn low? Lots of opportunities in stage 4, not very many of them get into stage 5. Well, we went back and looked at how did they get into stage 4, and we were able to mark them as stage 4 by things that I did, steps that I went to take to try to sell something. But in most cases, those customers that were in stage 4 in the database, at stage 4 in Salesforce.com, they hadn't done the things that a customer needs to do to even get out of stage 2. So we thought they were in stage 4 ready to buy something. They, in fact, were in stage 2, nowhere near ready to buy. And so it's no surprise then that we would find that not many of them were convert to five, because nobody jumps from stage two to stage five.
Right. So absence of things like economic buyer, absence of confirmation of budget, absence of the motive, urgency, and consequence, right? Or even accept. So one of the things that we try and move on is acceptance. More so, like, I can create an ROI spreadsheet for you all day long. I've done it my whole life, right? But I need you to accept it.
Yeah.
And when you accept it as the buyer, then I know that we've got confirmation that that is something that we agree on. So, you know, we call it seeking agreements. But seeking an agreement on what the consequence is in some way, shape, or form that you can then the buyer can then go use into market internally to go, you know, bargain for budget. Because they're gonna have to get for our product, you're typically not budgeted in the first year at least. And so we've got to go out there and go and get discretionary budget from somebody who these days is not very willing to give it up.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I was talking with a friend of mine yesterday about the current reality. And that is that many companies are starting to operate, the term for it is a zero budget management, which means that there is no budget ahead of time for things. We just don't take last year's spending plan and somehow mark it up by 7% and apply it to this year. Zero-based budgeting means we're going to take it all the way back down to we're not spending money on anything unless you, someone in the organization, convinces me, the CFO, that we absolutely have to spend this money. And so with zero-based budgeting and that kind of mentality, budgets are being slashed and people don't have discretionary funds to do anything with. So they're going to have some sort of a, you said, an ROI spreadsheet or a business case to go make their internal sale. But I dare say that many sellers have now discovered this, and a typical finance executive has got all kinds of business cases on his or her desk.
All of them.
Right. I could spend $1 million here and get 10 million back. I could spend $500,000 here and get 5 million back. And over what period of time and this and that. So in the end, it's not just a, can this investment return money? It's, can this investment return money, but also drive our organization toward our goals and objectives? What is it we're trying to do? So as sales professionals, we have to understand directionally, what's the organization trying to accomplish? What do they want to tell their investors, whether that's private investors and small business owners or medium-sized business, or whether this is Wall Street? What are they going to tell their investors they're going to accomplish in the next couple of years? And then does this investment align with that? Because there's what I call a line of available resources. It's an imaginary line that gets drawn above which we're going to spend money and put our time and energy and effort into. Below that line of available resources are a lot of really cool investments that we're never going to do because we just don't have the time and the bandwidth and cash to do it. So you said an ROI spreadsheet all day long. Yeah, that's meaningless unless it ties back to a goal or objective that's above the line.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. Because the ROI spreadsheet is really just, I mean, everyone has one, to your point. And that just like qualifies the conversation, but it doesn't actually map back to how the decision was made. It was how the decision was justified. So when we take a look at, when you take a look at those at that moment, and you mentioned something when we first opened up, and I kind of wrote a note down around the personal objectives. So we just talked briefly about the company objectives. So let's talk a bit about the personal objectives. Now, I've always found that to be a little bit more, and this is where I think sales is where sales won't be, in this particular case, won't be replaced by an AI anytime soon, is really something. My perspective is understanding the personal objectives of the people who have discretionary authority. So how, please just share some ideas on that and thoughts on that, like the person versus the corporate goals and objectives, which we can kind of like generalize, but how do you begin to get to understand the personal objectives of the person who's going to be helping you, you know, close this deal?
Very good. So I have this little diagram I teach in my workshops. I call it 10 denominations of value. And it starts out going around this circle with things that are very measurable and very kind of the business oriented, right? You got economic value and time value and quality value and all these things that are kind of higher level, you know, you talk about in the boardroom. And as you work your way around this, it actually gets to things that become far more personal. But interestingly enough, the things that are personal often drive decisions more than the things that are somehow corporate and more measurable. It's the intangible, unmeasurable things that tend to drive people's decisions. So which one's easiest? Which one's makes me look the best? P- positions me best for a promotion, or as one buyer who I lost a sale to years and years ago told me the reason afterwards, Bill, if I implemented your software, nobody would care, but I went and bought from another software company with a big name. And if I implement that here, that's going to look better on my resume. So there are a lot of things that would drive a person toward just simplicity value or avoiding looking bad and what have you. So first of all, we need to understand, what are those things? Mm-hmm. What are the things that are more personal in nature? It's seldom about personal income, coincidentally. Same thing with salespeople. We think that salespeople are only driven by money. No, they're usually driven by dignity. Mm-hmm. They're usually driven by opportunity to grow professionally and gain new responsibilities and maybe build a team and have something to show besides just hitting quota. So if we know what those personal things are, then we need to craft some questions to ask those kinds of, to discover those kinds of things. So for example, I have a whole series of diagnostic questions that I teach in our workshops. And these diagnostic questions, for example, are, if you could get this completed, this goal you're trying to achieve, you could get this completed by the end of next quarter, how much would that, how much do you think that would pay back in terms of return on investment for you? That's a money question, right? How much time might that save you? That's the time value question. Here comes the personal. If you could get this done, how would it make you look, John? Mm-hmm. If you could get this done, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I see. It's funny because, like, I find that, and maybe this kind of is my kind of more my more era or whatever, but like, I find it difficult to ask those questions on a Zoom call, but almost always ask those questions at the lobby bar. So how do we pack that in?
That's really, really good. You're exactly right. In person, in the same room, it's different.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons for that is privacy. If I'm in a room and the door's closed, that person knows that nobody else can hear. But if I asked you a question that's a little bit personal right now, there might be people listening to you on your end, walking into the room like they did a little bit ago, but there could also be somebody listening on my end, couldn't there? So it's like, are we really private here? Is this a private conversation? So you're absolutely right. But there's also something to be said for just that personal eye contact and body language that happens in a live meeting. So you make a really good point. Those kinds of questions around, what's the risk to you, John, if this thing doesn't work out? Those kinds of questions are definitely easier to deliver and easier to learn to master face-to-face. I want to say a couple more things about this. The reason that we wouldn't ask those kinds of questions is that we've maybe never done it before. People are hesitant. They're resistant to get into that level of conversation with their clients. Well, I feel like it's a little bit too personal. If you learn how to do this and you practice this a little bit, those are going to be your favorite questions. You're going to want to do it. So part of it then is just a familiarity and a expertise, if you will, of asking those kind of questions. Then that rolls over into the Zoom call. Because after a lot of years of doing this, I'll get right up in their business, even on a Zoom call, and say, okay, Bob, can I ask you, I'm going to ask you a personal question. Is that okay with you? Yeah, go ahead. What if this whole thing blows up and this project kind of went south? What kind of an impact would that have on you? That's a question not very many salespeople will ask, but that's how to reveal what's really going on in their heart. Here's another good one. So Bob, you're considering doing this. I know that. And you haven't made any buying decisions yet. I totally get it. But if you decided to move forward with this, who else would you have to have on your team? Right? You usually can't make a decision all by yourself on something this big. Who else would need to agree with you, do you suppose? And those kind of questions get into this personal side. Well, I've got a CFO and she's a real tough one. I'd have to get her on board. Well, maybe I can help you with persuading your CFO to make this investment. And I want to get to a place by becoming intimate enough with the customer, their own fears, their own internal buying challenges, maybe their own hesitance to understand what's really holding them back.
Do you find that those kind of conversations, like, where do they land in the journey of, in the buyer's journey? Because, like, you know, often you hear, you know, deals in stage five and it's kind of going sideways and the gaps haven't been closed. You know, when you talk about that, I heard the great expression a few shows back, called the cost of inaction. So COI ROI, yep. Right? So yep. And I hadn't heard it, for some reason I'd never heard it before. But calculating the cost of inaction and then asking those personal questions, are those pre-deal qualifiers? Are those things that you use once the deal has been sales accepted and looking to bring that through the funnel? Like, is that a pull or is that a qualifier?
Man, you are really good at asking questions. Oh. I got to invite you to come on my show so you can just ask some questions.
I'd love to. Trying to figure it as we're, you know, it's a state of trying to figure it out, right? Like at what point do you kind of go and qualify?
Yeah, this is really, really good. So I had, you mentioned Chris Whitaker. So I had, Chris Whitaker called me up. He's a good friend of mine. He called me up yesterday and he's like, Bill, I'm studying AI a little bit here because I'm doing a presentation on it. You really need to write a book on how to sell with AI. And so he's not the first person that told me this. And I responded by saying, well, Chris, that's fine. And who knows, maybe I should. I mean, I didn't know the darndest thing about digital selling until I decided I needed to write this book. And so then I learned a lot about it. But what I told him was I'm more interested in HI, human intelligence. I want to help people and I want to help people get better. So the reason I said that is to say, we're going to have to trust our instincts. So when it's the right time to ask that question. Mm-hmm. Sales is a little bit like dating, you know, yet sometimes you just don't at your first coffee, you just don't say, would you like to meet my mother? It's just a little premature at that point. So you kind of got to figure out where's the right time to start introducing these questions. But that being said, you got to ask this stuff as early as you possibly can. Let me explain. Mm. The further the customer works through their buying process, the higher the risk to them, the more nervous they get. The more uncomfortable they are, the more they've talked to various different people and they're afraid to make a commitment, the more their boss is expecting a resolution at a certain time, they get to a place where they actually oftentimes go dark and don't want to talk to us. We have to ask those kind of questions before they get into that, what I call the black space or this black cloud, this black hole where they don't want to talk to us. Because when you get into stage four, and you're trying to close on stage five and it's a week before the end of the quarter, they're not going to ask those kind of questions. It would be rude to ask them that kind of a question.
Yeah.
We got to do it early enough on and make it just a natural part of it. Yeah, we want to solve this. We want to solve that. We want to solve this. We're trying to do this and trying to do that. That sounds great, Mr. Johnson. You know, I think we really might be able to help you. But can I ask a question? What if you didn't get this done by the end of next year? I mean, what if it kind of fell short? What bad thing might happen? That's the kind of question that gets people to open up and think more personally about this. Mm-hmm. And I think we should learn to and practice it enough to decide to become really an expert at asking those questions early on, because that's when you have a chance to build rapport. Every step you take toward that closure, they become a little bit more closed and guarded. The most open they'll ever be is after you've broken the ice at the very beginning to start to really build that broader relationship with the individual and with other people in the company as well.
Yeah, you talk about the going dark, right? And everybody feels that all the time. You know, I'm getting ghosted, I'm getting ghosted, I'm getting ghosted. And I've got deals that, you know, we've got a deal in, another sales qualifier, it's not a deal yet. But they, you know, they expressed a significant amount of pain in the very first call, like, right out of the gates. And so I thought I had something that was hot here. And then, you know, we brought on the, you know, the, also the user champion, right? User champion came into the conversation, had that call. Okay, that was really positive. But we all agree that this is something that needs to be solved. And then nothing, right? And so as a salesperson, you know, there's you know, one thing as a truism, you know, be relentless, follow up, be persistent, and all these things. But, you know, we're all also kind of tired of writing emails that say, hey, you know, Bill, I'm just following up. It's just, you know, what kind of coaching do you give in those situations when someone's gone dark? Like the emails, you really want to provide value and you really want an update. You really want to get a response out of them. And somehow it's just like, it just seems not unnatural, but it seems unvaluable to ask kind of the classic, hey, just checking in, where are we at? Because it really is about me. I'm not asking about you. Like, so what kind of coaching do you give in that conversation?
Yeah, boy, that's like you said,
it's a ghosted deal.
It doesn't help them at all, does it? In fact, those kinds of email follow-ups just serve to make me look pretty desperate in most cases. So, okay, here's a chance to talk a little bit about digital selling. I decided to understand digital selling a few years ago. I decided I need to understand it because I was wanted to use it for prospecting, meeting more people who are not responding well to emails and telephone calls the way that they once did. But what I discovered through this process of deciding to master the art of digital selling is that today, the digital selling takes place throughout the entire process, not just at the beginning. So I do see people who will read a book or come to a workshop and say, all right, well, I've learned some new techniques on LinkedIn, for example, to get people to respond and book an appointment with them. But once they book that first appointment, they go right back to selling the old way they did in 2010, and they're not using technology to keep the sales conversation going. You asked a good question. And I answer questions as if I've got all the answers. I don't know if I've got all the answers, but I'm confident, doggone it. So here was the reason they don't call you back is they don't need to. Yeah. They have all the information that they need online, looking at LinkedIn, reading our website, our competitor's website, or probably on ChatGPT or Watson X or you know, Copilot, something like that. They don't need to talk to us. So if they don't need to talk to us, most people today are not going to talk to us. So what are they doing? We have to think about what are they doing? They're out reading things, watching things, and listening to things to get additional information that they need to continue through the decisions of their buying process. So here's the question. If they're going to go watch a YouTube video, if they're going to go read a white paper, if they're going to go download somebody's report or go read a website, the question is, who's providing those digital assets? Who recorded that video? Who wrote the white paper? Who's providing the report that they're going to look at that talks about the 11 ways to maximize your return on investment in fill in the blank, whatever you sell? This is where digital selling really changes the game. What we have to do is provide the digital assets. These are things that are the written word, infographics, audio, and video. Those four things is what comprise digital assets. We have to provide the digital assets that they can read, watch, and listen to. Otherwise, they're going to go find somebody else's digital assets to read, watch, and listen to. And I don't know about you.
Interesting.
Yeah. You know, I don't know about you, but I am now hiring people to work for me based on their YouTube videos. So I need to hire somebody to help me do color grading on some new video I'm shooting for my new podcast, my video podcast, which is going to launch here in a couple of weeks. So we need to do some professional video grading. So I went on YouTube to learn about video grading. I found an expert and I contacted him. I said, you're hired. I want some help. Well, he said, I'm in Singapore. So I can only work with you between 9 p.m. and 5 a.m. Okay. I went back on YouTube. I found another color grading expert and that person's happy to work with me on my time zone and I hired them. So I'm doing my searching for qualified candidates to help me do things out on YouTube. And your customers are too. My customers are out looking for solutions to problems and they're doing it on YouTube and ChatGPT. So if we can't be found on YouTube and ChatGPT, we basically don't exist.
So the one of the key things that I just kind of heard there is the be found. Right. And so one of the things that we ask in the show often, and in addition, just kind of like the whole industry of SEO, like when we talk about what we sell, we often articulate it in our terms.
Yeah.
Not so much in the customer's terms.
Yeah.
So how do we make sure that we're producing content that can be found in the customer's terms?
Yeah.
How do you tune that?
Whew, this is good stuff, man. I didn't know we were going to talk about this. I'm more excited about this show every minute. I love it.
There you go.
And we only got an hour here, right? I think we're going to need to fire this puppy up again next Tuesday.
We'll do a part two.
Okay. Here's what I would suggest. Get every smart person that you know at your company or even beyond your company together and do a brainstorming session. And maybe even poll your customers in this process and find out what are the top 20 questions your customers need an answer to right now. So I actually sent out a little request to about 30 or 40 sales executives that I've known over the years, been doing this a long time. So I know a lot of sales leaders. And I said, what's the number one problem you're faced with right now leading your sales team? And I got tons of responses. I turned those into questions. And now I'm naming my podcast episodes the question.
The question.
Naming the question so that when people go out and type in, how do you X, Y, or Z, it'll find it. I use ChatGPT a lot, just in my personal life and my business life. And I love how ChatGPT, when you ask it a question, for example, I could say, how do you do color grading in Adobe Premiere Pro when you've shot in using a Sony camera using S-Log format, and push the button? And it'll come up with some answers. And then at the bottom, it'll say, you might find this video helpful. And there's a YouTube video on there you can go watch. Have you noticed that?
Yeah.
ChatGPT gives you YouTube links all the time now. We got to be the YouTube link. And the way you become the YouTube link is that you name your episodes the questions that people are asking. Now, this is not brand new. People have
there's a really good book. There's a really good book called They Ask, Can You Answer?
Yes.
Who wrote it?
Yes.
It's outstanding. Riverfront Pools. Yeah. Who wrote the book? Who wrote the book again?
I don't know. I can't remember his name, but yeah. I watch his stuff on LinkedIn all the time. It's great.
Yeah. It really kind of got me thinking about that space. And I'll give you one other, following your train of thought. One thing that we've done is that, you know, there's podcasts for everything, is we take industry podcasts and download the transcripts and load all the transcripts into GPT. So if there's an industry podcast on whatever, my world is maintenance, product management maintenance, and I'll download all the transcripts I can find, put them into a GPT, and then use that to kind of understand the questions that are being asked. Yeah. And then what I'll do is I'll load our sales deck into that GPT and evaluate it against the language that the customers are using. Because I want to make sure that I eliminate all of my bias. Because I have my favorite words, but those are useless when I'm thinking about an SEO, what the customer is typing into Google.
Man, that's
and
so true.
Things like that. There's that. And then also just call transcripts. Like I've yet to find a more valuable asset these days in terms of like what we're doing for selling than capturing call transcripts, which begin to interfere with the ability to pull out personal information. But nonetheless, in terms of like technical discovery and just sales process, like it being able to dig in and smoke test a forecast, if you can double click in through into a call transcript and look at the call transcripts, you're able to do that. And in fact, I download our transcripts and tune the GPT to coach me on how I've handled objections and how I've actually, I always say, rate this sales call. Oh, this is a 6 out of 10. You could have done these things better. And so that gives me sales coaching in real time. So maybe you could think yourself as a Bill Stinnett GPT for sales coaching.
The funny thing is you can go in ChatGPT and they're reading every book out there, right? You see all these books? ChatGPT's already read them all. And that's so if you ask that kind of question, it's going to pull all the best answers from all these into that. But you're making a really good point. As I was figuring out what to name episodes, I did the exact same thing with ChatGPT and said, you know, what are the top 20 or 50 questions that sales leaders are asking? There are also companies, I'm trying to remember the name of one of them right now. I'd give them a plug, but there are companies that actually will pull data from Google and from YouTube and show you literally what people are typing in. The SEO industry has been doing that for years. And so that's what we have to get good at, is answering questions that people are already asking. And they're asking them digitally. There was a time when the only way they could get an answer to that question was to call us or email us, fill out the form on our website, accept a telephone call back so they could ask the question. Today, 90% of their questions can be asked online, answered online.
Anonymously at any hour without having to show up at someone's sales pipeline.
I can do it sitting in my house in pajamas if I want to.
Yeah, or less.
Totally.
Right? Yeah, no kidding. Outstanding. So as we kind of come to a close, we got about 5 minutes here. What kind of instruction, and we were all, we covered a wide breadth of conversation.
That is fun.
When folks are looking at the sales world today and all the impacts of the last, let's just even the last quarter, and you know, they're seeking to maybe understand the scope of challenges before them for a Q2, what kind of advice would you give them in terms of like things they could start doing tomorrow, things they could start doing on Friday?
Yeah. Let's see. What could you do tomorrow? I would say one thing would be to make sure everybody on your team knows how to leverage AI for doing what you and I just talked about. Just right. Asking questions about things. One time I was going to spend $250,000. I had it literally priced out to develop a database that you could query that would be specific to our product set, whatever we have for sale as a company, any of my clients, industry. Right. So what we sell to, let's say, the pharmaceuticals, and also specific to a role. So I'm going to go talk to the CFO of a pharmaceuticals industry about the kind of things that I sell. What are the questions that I should ask? What are the conversation starters and that kind of thing? What are the good qualifying kinds of questions that I should ask along the way? I never did that. But now we all have that, and it doesn't cost time. Yeah. You can go right out to ChatGPT or any one of these, WatsonX, any one of these, and literally type in, I'm getting ready to go meet with the CFO of a pharmaceutical company. I want to talk to them about 5G, IoT, you know, management sensors across, an enterprise. What are some of the things that CFO might be concerned about? Ask questions about what should I be prepared to answer? What would their top three questions be? It is incredible how much of a personal mentor it can be. And I got to be completely frank with this. I think this is one of the reasons that just traditional sales training will probably be absolutely obsolete in a few years, because you can go have a conversation with ChatGPT and get the answer to any question you've got.
Yeah, no, definitely. Do you find that there's now no excuse for not being prepared?
Oh, there's still an excuse. Bad time management. Yeah. But more important than that is that people don't believe that preparation is important. This is what we didn't get to today, and what we probably need to get to in part two. Is I've gone back to my roots in psychology, as you brought up earlier, and I've developed a whole new curriculum around how to get people to think different and change the way that they sell. And so this is going to be the future for me. Because sales techniques are a dime a dozen, it seems, these days. What's really crucial is how do people change? And so it's understanding then the motive of the people that to make these changes and what it is they believe. So if somebody doesn't prepare for a meeting, what that tells me is they don't think it matters. Because if they thought it mattered and they really understood the value of it and they proved to themselves how it helped them, they'd be doing it. So it's a belief level problem. It's not a behavior problem. It's a belief level problem, which we need to talk about in the next episode.
I've got something else we'll throw in there. So definitely in the next episode of the books. Also in the next episode, I'd like to riff on virtual assistants in sales.
Oh, okay.
But that's because I just want to plant that seed, because I've had a ton of success, and it's absolutely incredible. In terms of the what you just discussed, being prepared, virtual assistants and preparing your buyer, right? Mm-hmm. I've been finding so much success in terms of that. And it's been a force multiplier for my efforts in my day. So we'll save that for the next show. Stay tuned, everyone, for that one. Well, thank you so much, Bill, for today. It's been outstanding catching up with you and hearing what you've got to say. Well, how can we get a hold of you? And what's the best way to connect?
Yeah, thank you. So salesexcellence.com. If you're interested in this new podcast we're going to come out with, you can go to salesexcellence.com/podcast and come check us out. We're going to talk about solving the world's problems one belief set at a time.
Wonderful. Thank you. And for everyone listening today, I'm being down in my room. Thank you for listening for today. Appreciate everyone logging in and getting to Hell Yes. Follow us on LinkedIn. Follow us on Apple or Spotify. And thanks for tuning in. I'm bounced. Take care, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And I am bounced. We'll catch